You're listening to All the Best. I'm Pip Rasmussen. Today's episode of All the Best, the future is now. It's not a very full audience today, is it? Not the best turnout for the robotics convention. Nah, it's not a convention. It's a competition that will change the world. One farm at a time. Okay, so here are the teams. UTS, Sydney, obviously. And QUT Club A. As if Macquarie got knocked out on the home ground.
Girl.
So embarrassing. Oh my god, I'm so excited to commentate these. Look, there it is.
I know.
There it is.
On its starter box.
1 minute until the robots
fight.
If only. I visited Macquarie Uni with a friend to watch a robot competition. At first, I thought it was going to be like that old TV show where robots would fight in a ring. But turns out these robots weren't made for miniature battles with stabbing arms and flamethrowers. No, they were much more important. Robots to plant and sow seeds for farms.
One, go.
Okay, and they're off. Holy shit, that one's quite fast. Go, son, go. Okay, now he's putting a...
Oh, it's going to the corner. And then they put the ball into the rectangular thingies.
And now it's like rolling towards.
Going around an obstacle, a wall.
I don't know what those lines represent, but obviously it's going
to go over it.
Oh, it's going to drop the ball, I reckon.
Oh, yeah,
there we go.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Nice.
It's actually quite fast.
Yeah.
So now it's like backing up, it's like reversing or going back into its little original box.
And then back onto.
Yeah, there we go.
Into the start box again.
Yes.
So you win.
UTS, look how slow it's going. It's like, bro, no competition. I can't believe I judged that robot by its cover. Because that was a lot, but
it's doing a wheelie,
bro. It's like tried to mount the little brick wall. Students from Australia and New Zealand had to make a robot that could wirelessly communicate with their controllers to navigate the obstacle paths, collect seeds, and deposit them before rolling on home.
But I like the look of University of Melbourne.
Retro looks cool. It's like a cheese block with wheels. With a spoiler.
Spoiler?
It's got a spoiler bra.
And some flushing lights.
Oh my god, yeah. So cool. The guys look a lot older. They don't look like students. Also, UNSW is wearing silly hats, if that matters. 15 seconds until they go.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
Oh, it's like yellow. Oh my god, it's so fast.
Oh, it has a little doggy.
Oh yeah, there's a dog on them. Oh my god, it's got like flashing lights on the back, like Tetris. Bro.
University of Melbourne's struggling a little bit.
Oh, it's... Yes, yes.
It's turning.
Go, UNSW. You got your little red thing, go. Melbourne is...
Still struggling.
Still struggling. It's stuck in the corner. UNSW is going for the win. It's a dog with a top hat. Wow, it's really quick.
It is. Dropping the...
Dropping the little red thing.
Dice. And then
going back.
In there. Nice.
Oh, yes.
Hit the wall, but it is going to its corner. And under 50... It's 56 seconds.
Boom. Melbourne, cheese block.
Cheese block.
Not happening. Remember in the 80s, we used to think that we would have flying cars by 2000? Okay, so we didn't get that far ahead. But that future of where robots are taking everyday jobs of everyday people? That's happening right now.
Machine or mannequin?
Secret, I've got a secret.
And that's the theme for today's show. Things we thought belonged in that shiny or dystopian future are already here. And that includes climate change. But first up, robotic ears. There's a place in Melbourne called the Bionics Institute. They've researched the brain and found that hearing loss plays a huge factor in cognitive decline, meaning memory and ability to pay attention and multitask. So they decided to fix it. Joel Carnegie got hooked up to some machines in the name of radio and science to bring us this story on the bionic ear.
This is our little history cabinet with our very first speech processor, which was in a bit of pipe that was squashed flat, to the first wearable one here.
That's Professor Colette McKay. She leads the Translational Hearing Research Group at the Bionics Institute in Melbourne and has recently returned from England as a Vesky Innovation Fellow. I'm at the Institute gearing up to have electrodes plugged into my brain. And why? Well, there's some startling new research out. More on that in a moment. But first, we're invited on a guided tour of the Institute.
So this is the cap where we have light emitters and light detectors. It's a new sort of imaging called functional near-infrared spectroscopy. And so we can put that on the head and we can actually measure the way the brain's working in different parts of the brain. So that's our new toy that we're really excited to use.
And what will that help be able to detect?
Well, what we're looking at is the effect of how the brain has been changed by deafness. Okay, so before you get a cochlear implant or a hearing aid, if you've been deaf for a while, the hearing part of your brain doesn't like to be idle, so it starts doing visual work and somatosensory work. And so when you get a cochlear implant, you've got to sort of win back that part of your hearing brain to make it work properly. So we're looking at prognostic tools, you know, so before implant, how well people are going to do and how much training they might need. So Hamish will measure if your brain works when we put sounds in your ear.
Okay. Okay. And you're the expert in
electrophysiology, how the recording brain waves from the brain while we're listening to sounds.
Well, I think you're going to hook me up to this machine, so let's go for a wander.
Okay, let's go.
Okay,
so
all right.
I've got this big, comfortable chair. So for a normal testing that we do, it can be quite lengthy, like you can be in the chair for an hour or so.
Well, it's only recently been shown that hearing loss is a very big risk factor for cognitive decline.
These are the four electrodes that will go onto your head.
And so if you've got hearing loss, even if it's only a very mild hearing loss, your rate of cognitive decline is up to 40% steeper than someone with normal hearing. So that means that as you get old, you're at much greater risk of having dementia and other things like that. So this means that apart from the actual direct influence of hearing loss on your communication ability, your social ability, your ability to find jobs, all that sort of thing, it's actually affecting your cognitive skills as well. And so it's sort of like a vicious circle.
Where is my
Hamish is trying to work out the best way to use this measurement to actually know when you first hear a sound. And we're going to use that to actually program cochlear implants for babies. So these days, babies as young as 4 months old get a cochlear implant, and we can't ask them when do they hear a sound and how loud it is. So we're using these sorts of measurements to actually program the cochlear implant for the babies.
Okay, so if you can hear that, maybe I'll put it next to the microphone. So that is what's called a chirp, that sound. So each one of those tiny little clicks that you're hearing is actually a very rapidly increasing frequency sweep, so it starts off with very low frequencies and then kind of goes whoop, but very, very quickly, and you're listening to about 20 per second. So we're going to plug this into your ear in a second with a little foam ear tip.
Yep.
And then the electrodes will be measuring the response of some structures in your brain stem to every one of those little tiny chirps.
Go. All right, I guess we turn this mic off and then we come back and we'll see what happens after this. All right, here we go. Turn off time.
So one of the things that we need to do is to work out whether treating the hearing loss helps to slow the cognitive decline. You know, if you actually give people with the mild hearing loss hearing aid earlier, does that actually slow the cognitive decline? We don't know the answers to that. We need to find out quite quickly, because, you know, if that does slow it, then we actually need a national campaign to make people aware of this, because, you know, much of the hearing loss that people develop through their life is due to cumulative noise exposure and things like that. So if you can actually take action to prevent yourself from being exposed to loud noises, and also other things like that are bad for the ears, like certain chemicals and things like that, if you can protect yourself, then you're going to be in a much better position.
How would you define what cognitive decline means?
Well, there are very specific aspects of cognition that are measured, things like memory and ability to pay attention to things, ability to executive function. So executive function is being able to sort of make your brain switch between tasks in a methodical way.
Joining us today is Professor Colette McKay, and we're discussing the interesting discoveries of late and suggesting that cognitive decline is very much linked to hearing loss, with some statistics suggesting that by 2050, a significant amount of the population are going to be struggling with this phenomenon. Do you suggest that this phenomenon, which will affect those, you know, the Gen Y generation, for instance, who have grown up with, you know, the earbuds in the ears listening to high music, or is this something that's more systemic of a noisier society?
It's partially both. It's probably more systemic. There's been a lot of concern about the levels at which young people are listening to their earphones, but there hasn't been much evidence that they listen to them for long enough to actually do much harm in general, on average, that is.
Jove Niren had perfect hearing until he was exposed to an explosion whilst serving in the army. And following a bad bout of flu later in life, he lost hearing in both of his ears. After receiving a cochlear implant in 2005, Jove regained hearing, but is now alarmed at the findings of this new research suggesting links between cognitive decline and hearing loss.
It's a shame that it's going to happen, because it's not just this person is going to suffer that problem, but society at large. I mean, we all have to fork out, and socially and also economically, it's going to be very bad if a lot more people lose their hearing.
All right, free to move.
Okay, what's going on? What are the results?
Well, we can see, so these lines here represent the average signal that was recorded. So every time there was one of those tiny little clicks, which happened every about 30 times per second, the computer has collected that a little segment of data from the electrodes for every chirp, and then averaged them all together.
I'm calling that I've passed the examination.
Oh, a definite pass. Yeah, there's something happened in your brainstem to those clicks. Yeah.
What are some of the practical tips for preventing hearing loss in the long term?
Earplugs, earplugs, earplugs.
That was Joel Carnegie, who hooked himself up to a bionic ear in the name of science. And of all the best. I'm Pip Rasmussen, and on today's show, we're hearing stories from the future. But the future is now. While we debate whether climate change is happening, or whether it's our fault, or what we should do about it, for some people, climate change isn't a theory, or even part of a theoretical future. It's real and now and part of their lives. Josie Wright spent a weekend in Newcastle with the Pacific Warriors, for whom a climate change-affected future is all too present.
A couple of months ago, I went to a friend's village, and because I live in the city, I thought it would be great to go down to the beach first. So we went down to the beach, and the waves, when I looked across, I saw the waves crashing into the cemetery. And so I asked my friend, is there a reason why the people are being buried so close to the sea? And my friend was saying that it was never like that before, but due to, you know, coastal flooding and the sea level rising at a rapid level, land is being washed away, and, you know, in the Pacific, you know, our land is our life.
So there's this beach I always go to when I'm home, where the waves crash against these towering lumpy rocks. You can jump off them when the tide's high and snorkel around them when it's low. It's something that seems permanent, the sea. We all know about climate change by now, but the effects seem so far away, the sea taking over the land. I imagine it happening to generations that I'll never meet.
We've had two villages relocated back in the island in Fiji, but they moved further inland, and that's Fiji. But for islands like Tuvalu, Tokelau, all these atoll islands, Kiribati, you can stand from one side of the island and see and look to the other side, and it's a narrow island, so I mean, they can't move inland. Yeah. So those are the impacts.
That's Aaron and George, two of the Pacific Warriors. They're a group of young people from 12 island countries throughout the Pacific, like Tonga, Samoa, Marshall Islands, Fiji and Vanuatu. They've been active at home for about 5 years now, learning and then teaching others in their communities about how best to combat or cope with climate change. Their message, which they've been getting out through savvy YouTube videos and through social media, is, "We are not drowning, we are fighting." To bring that message home to Australia, they've spent the last year learning to craft ancestral canoes, which they've brought here for a very specific purpose.
Because the commitment of Australia's commitment to the expansion of fossil fuel industries is ridiculous. I mean, that's exporting destruction to the islands. And we, the people of Pacific, we identify with the land.
We have some of the biggest carbon emissions per capita in the world, and we're pretty enthusiastic about investing in fossil fuels, despite a global shift towards renewables.
And I tell you, like, most of the villages and communities that have been relocated, they leave behind the ancestral burial grounds. And these have been swept away by the rising sea levels. And
a few weeks ago, 30 of the warriors staged a flotilla blockade in Newcastle Port, which is the biggest coal port in the world. 350.org say that, according to 2010 statistics, if the port were a country, it would be the ninth biggest emitter in the world. It makes sense then that that's where the warriors chose to do their blockade. It's almost like they were blockading a whole nation. I headed down on the train to join in on the blockade. There were just hundreds of people milling around. The barbecues were already fired up and you could smell falafel and tofu in the air. There were heaps of people, people of all walks of life. There were babies and dogs in the sand and businessmen and journalists toddling around on high heels. Ladies with long grey hair and hippies with dreadlocks, activists. There were about 7 canoes that the warriors made. They were all really intricately crafted, though at the same time, you could tell that they'd been handmade. When they took them out on the water, one of them actually sunk immediately and they were a bit wobbly and lopsided. The warriors did a big welcoming ceremony and they did the haka and they chanted and the women did a really beautiful dance and then they launched their canoes. The warriors went out on the water and then a few minutes later all of the local supporters took a bunch of hired canoes out. There were about 100 that they'd hired from places around Newcastle. I caught up with Blair Palese. She's the CEO of 350.org.
My name's Blair Palese and I run 350.org here in Australia. Today there are 30 Pacific Island warriors who've come from 12 island countries. They've built handmade canoes and they've shipped them over to block the world's largest shipping terminal here in Newcastle that carts coal through. And they've been on the water since about 10:30 this morning with support canoes, about 50 support canoes of, you know, Australians who are there to support what they're doing. The first ship's just come through. We don't know that it's a coal ship, but they've been blockading it and the police are on the scene.
Not long after that, I got into a canoe myself. When we got in the canoe at first, the atmosphere was pretty calm. Everyone was having a good time. So we paddled out and hung out in the water for a while. But while we were there, the second coal ship was announced as coming through and the police started surrounding the blockade and the atmosphere turned a little bit more tense after that.
The police have asked a couple of people for their names. You are required to give them your name. If you do give them your name, tell us with a yellow armband, just so we know. But that's it. So keep going and have an amazing time, everyone, and get out there.
The coal ship was utterly enormous. There was one stage when I saw it coming towards me and I thought that part of the Newcastle CBD had detached from the land. sort of heaved up really, really slowly. I thought, that's not a ship. That is the biggest thing I've ever seen. There were police on jet skis and also in larger boats. The ones on jet skis were kind of whipping around. The waves got quite violent, and so at one point they were pulling people out of their canoes and taking their oars and just like trying to push us back to shore. I talked to Chloe Schofield from the University of Sydney Enviro Collective. She was out on the water as well, and she had a bit of a run-in with the police.
So there was a ship trying to get through the blockade, and we were behind the Pacific Warriors. And the cops started getting really aggressive, and they started, like, they're on, like, jet skis, yeah? So they keep, like, charging you or, like, just doing big donuts in front of you, like, splashing everyone with, like, huge waves. And they're like, we're really concerned for your safety! And then they, like, charged the boats and stuff. One cop charged into our boat, except he was, like, in, like, a huge 14-seater boat. And then he grabbed my paddle and screams in my face, get back to shore! And I'm like, yeah, okay, like, how though? Because you took my paddle. And then he's like, I will charge you with failure to comply. I'm like, I literally couldn't comply if I wanted to.
Although it got pretty tense out on the water between the protesters and the police, the atmosphere on the day overall was overwhelmingly positive. When I got back to shore, it was like a beach party had started. People were dancing around, eating food. Kids were playing in the sand. I spoke to a couple more of the warriors that had been out in the water in the day. They were playing Bob Marley. Of course, they were playing Get Up, Stand Up.
You would think that a mix of cultures would be, I don't know, would create a crazy, crazy environment. But this has been really beautiful. People from different backgrounds and different cultures have come together and really united in this fight. So it's really beautiful.
That's Malung Loyak. She's the daughter of the president of the Marshall Islands and also one of the Pacific Island Warriors.
To get our message out there so the big decision makers can make better decisions for us and for Australia and for people all over the world, just for the whole planet in general.
There are plans afoot to more than double the export capacity of this port. We know about the risks of dangerous climate change. We know that small island nations are already getting regular storm surges and could disappear under the map.
That was Jonathan Moylan. His name might be familiar. He was the guy that put out the fake press release that temporarily wiped off about $350 million from the Whitehaven coal share price.
There could be declines of global agricultural productivity, but when we're in a position where governments are looking after the corporate interest instead of the public interest, when we've seen so many corruption scandals here and around the world, we know that if change is going to happen, it's going to come from us. It's not going to come from asking nicely. We've tried asking nicely, and now it's time to take our own future back into our hands.
At the end of the day, Siam Ayaba, the chief of the warriors, spoke in the concluding ceremony. I'd watched him all day out on the water in his kayak. He'd been yelling and rousing up all the other warriors. He'd been doing the haka and running through the water. He seemed really powerful and fierce, but when he spoke later on, he had a real softness and grace to his voice.
But it's important that we stay strong. We stay strong together. You know, you might go fast somewhere by yourself, but you will go further if we all stand together. And let that be a message from us, that we should all stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters here in Australia, or in New Zealand, or in Tuvalu, or even making a canoe in Vanuatu, and all of the world. Let us continue to stay in solidarity.
Siam Ayaba's speech made me think of my beach at home and how precious it is to me. The warriors teach us that the connection that we all have with the land is what makes us human. They remind us how important it is that we stand up for that land and those connections if we want to continue to have them in the future.
Josie Wright and the Pacific Warriors.
And edited by Selena Shannon.
This episode of All the Best was produced at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne, and 4ZZZ in Brisbane.
Thanks to Joel Carnegie and Josie Wright for their stories in today's show. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan, and I'm Pip Rasmussen. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. For more stories from the future, head to allthebestradio.com.
It will be.